these people or this movement misuses this very same religion they refuse to follow. They misuse it in order to justify crimes which are forbidden in this very same religion.
You mean they use it as a pretext?
As a tool, as a propaganda tool. This is total hypocrisy. But unfortunately, people don't know these details. And what happens at the end of the day is that Zionist propaganda portrays this as the Jewish people, generally including all Jews, and as the Jewish religion. Now, nobody wants to be anti-Semitic. Nobody wants to fight the Jewish people, and they shouldn't. Nobody wants to fight God, and they shouldn't. But it's the other way around. By supporting the state of Israel, one is rebelling against God, because this movement is a rebellion against God. By supporting the state of Israel, one is not supporting the Jewish people. One places the Jewish people in danger. In addition to Palestinian people being in danger, Palestinian people being mass murdered, not only the past 2 years, but already for the past 77 years, but in addition to that, Jewish people are in danger because of what is taking place. We say that the state of Israel is the greatest exacerbation of anti-Semitism today. If one is concerned about anti-Semitism, this is a whole discussion. But it's the state of Israel placing the Jewish people in danger.
From your perspective, how have Israeli actions in Palestine affected the global image of Jewish communities?
The Zionist movement, especially with the actions they are taking against Palestine, have placed the Jewish people in a terrible situation, made a terrible image on the Jewish people. While Jewish people are supposed to be the people of the book, are supposed to be the pious people, friendly, peaceful, respectful, and so on, unfortunately, what the Zionist movement is doing, portraying an image as the Jewish people are one of the worst of humanity. This is wrong, dangerous, embarrassing, and a desecration of God's name.
How has Zionism contributed to rising anti-Semitism by linking Jewish identity to state violence?
One has to be very careful not to conflate Judaism with Zionism. What we are seeing today, whoever speaks up a word against horrific crimes committed by the state of Israel against the Palestinian people, they would be falsely accused as anti-Semitic, based on the notion that anti-Semitism equals anti-Zionism equals anti-Semitism, basically conflating Judaism with Zionism. Now, this is wrong. Why is it wrong? Just because it is wrong. Because Judaism and Zionism is not the same. Not all Jews support the state of Israel or its actions. Masses of Jewish people worldwide disagree and publicly oppose it. The Jewish religion is against all what is taking place. Now, this is wrong to conflate the two. It is wrong. It is doing an injustice to the Palestinian people, because what this false anti-Semitism accusation is doing, while anti-Semitism is a true concept, and is a concept that people should be concerned about, but when this is being misused, blaming whoever speaks up for justice in regards to the Palestinian people, blame them as anti-Semitic, this is obviously doing a terrible injustice for the Palestinian people, because this terribly oppressed people who are mass murdered, deserve the voice of the righteous people around the world to speak up for them. Because if not for those righteous people, who will? This is a terrible injustice for the Palestinian people. But in the same time, this is doing an injustice for the Jewish people. Because when you conflate Judaism and Zionism, you are making a statement. You are saying, as if, God forbid, all Jews support Israel, as if all Jews are behind all these crimes, which ends up making a statement that all Jews are accountable to what is taking place. This is dangerous. In addition to all dangers brought upon the Palestinian people, this is bringing so much danger to the Jewish people. And I can only encourage people of conscience to understand this. You are not supporting Jews by supporting Israel. If you choose to support Jews, we highly appreciate that. One should support Jews, one should support humanity, one should support everyone. But as a Jewish person, I definitely appreciate that. But supporting Israel is not support for the Jewish people.
So you think that Jewish communities abroad paid a social or security price for policies they did not choose to support?
Certainly. Jewish people, especially people who are visibly Jewish, when I travel in the airport, unless I have my kafir, I'm scared that people would misunderstand who I am. And unfortunately, people see somebody visibly Jewish, they associate it automatically with Zionism, with the State of Israel, and with these crimes. And this is unfair, because I don't deserve this. I don't support all of this.
Have you ever been personally threatened?
I was threatened by the Zionist movement. I was threatened by Zionists. But you can ask, and you might want to ask, whether I felt myself in danger when I visit Muslim countries, or I visit Gaza, or I attend pro-Palestinian rallies in Italy or any place of the world. And my answer is no. I never have a problem. I make sure to be visibly not the enemy, and I have no problem. Nobody hates me because I'm Jewish. People might have guilt feeling towards some Jews because they associate them with the State of Israel.
This takes me to the next question. How are anti-Zionist Jews treated within their own communities and by pro-Israel organizations?
Okay, very well asked. Their own communities and pro-Israeli, this is a great difference. How we are treated by pro-Israelis, very bad. Very bad in all different in different ways. But in the same time, while we can face difficulties, threats, physical attacks from pro-Israelis, we have massive support from other communities, from anti-Zionist communities, which is okay.
Do you think that, or do you feel that Jewish critics of Israel face censorship, marginalization, or smear campaigns in public discourse of the media?
Well, certainly there is a manipulation in the press. If it would have been honest journalism, I always say, I don't have to be in Italy if there is honest journalism, because everybody is going to understand everything and things will be very clear. Unfortunately, because it is this massive ignoring the voice of the righteous, therefore, the ordinary people almost have no choice and they don't have the proper information. And while they need to make their decisions, they have very little information to build their decisions on.
Why do you think Jewish opposition to Zionism receives so little coverage, so little international media coverage?
Not because it's Jewish, just because it's anti-Zionist. Whatever is anti-Zionist, the mainstream media will either ignore or vilify. It's not right, it's not just, it's not fair for the readers and for the listeners and for the viewers. People deserve honest journalism. And that's why I appreciate Press TV for being upfront, being honest, and bring for the people what they need, what they deserve.
How are ordinary Jewish civilians inside historical Palestine affected by constant militarization and war policies of the Israeli government?
I have to be very clear. The people suffering by the hands of the Zionist regime are not only the Palestinians. It is Jewish people who suffer as well. If you live in Israel, if you support the government, then you're okay. If you're silent, also okay. If you dare to speak up, then you'll be badly attacked. From arrests, harassments, physical attacks, night raids in the middle of the night, and assassinations from time to time. This is something that people need to understand, that the state of Israel is not the savior for the Jewish people. It is the protection for the Zionist movement. And whoever stands in their way, whether they are Palestinians or Jewish, would be attacked. And this happens on a daily basis.
What impact does compulsory military service and a culture of permanent fear have on Israeli society?
With these new laws in Israel forcing the youth to serve in the army, our communities are struggling. Our people fervently believe that this state of Israel has no right to exist. It has no right to exist morally. It has no right to exist religiously. And unfortunately, I have to be clear, this doesn't mean that these people believe that Jewish people should be killed. On the contrary, these are Jewish people. And they are concerned for the Jewish people, they are concerned for any human being. But this political movement of Zionism is something that is fundamentally wrong. Now, our people would never contribute to this rebellion against God, to this criminal movement. We would never serve in this Israeli army. The government is doing everything they can, the Israeli government, to force our people. When our boys and girls turn 17, automatically they become criminals because they don't serve. I have a close friend of mine who left or escaped the state of Israel, and his teenagers are still back there in Israel, and they have no choice. They can't leave. They reach the airport, they get arrested right away. This is this open-air prison where the Jewish people are being held hostage. This is unfair. People should have the right to conscientiously object to serve in an army which they religiously and morally believe is fundamentally wrong. And in no way should people be forced to carry out with their bare hands actions which they fundamentally oppose.
Rabbi, as a Jewish person, how do you personally feel when violence against Palestinians is justified in the name of Jewish security?
This is horrific for two reasons. First of all, even if the state of Israel would have been the safety of the Jewish people, how in the world can we justify this by oppressing an entire people? This is simply unacceptable. It is forbidden according to our religion. And it's our communities who suffered in the Holocaust. For example, it's my family, my communities, my mentors and rabbis who are Holocaust survivors. We know what suffering is, and we don't want this to happen to anyone. But this is wrong even if it would have been the safety for the Jewish people. Why in the world should we allow this to happen to others? Why should we do it to others? But it happens to be the other side, the other way around. The existence of the state of Israel and all the actions they are committing in the name of Jewish security is not only inflicting so many crimes on the Palestinian people, but endangering the Jewish people at the same time. This is a disaster for everyone involved. And we are encouraging Jewish people to rethink their blind support to Israel. Because, number one, this is wrong. Number two, this is dangerous for our people.
How painful is it personally to see acts of violence carried out while claiming to represent Judaism worldwide?
This is terribly frustrating, especially as religious people. The Jewish religion is the most precious by me more than my own life. Seeing that God's religion is being so badly misrepresented is deeply disturbing. And especially when we see this done by people who disregard this religion altogether. This is a total hypocrisy. If it would have been some people that might be misguided, and there are some people who are misguided and they do this out of their, like, their good intention, then it's an issue of mistake. We have to correct these errors. We have to educate them. But generally speaking, in the state of Israel, this is a vicious propaganda tool, intentionally misguiding people. There is no excuse.
Can you tell us about Jewish movements, Jewish organizations, Jewish groups today that openly oppose Zionism?
Jewish communities, we have strong Jewish communities in a number of parts of the world who are very publicly, vocally anti-Zionist. I'm from New York. New York is a very strong community. If you come visit our communities, you would find massive areas with tens of thousands of families with no Israeli flag, no celebration of the state of Israel. These communities are totally anti-Zionist. You go to Al-Quds, Jerusalem. You have a very strong anti-Zionist community. You go around in the area, you would find Palestinian flags on the walls, and then the police comes, Israeli police comes and remove them. It's a whole game. You have in London strong communities, in Canada. But you have so many other communities who are strongly anti-Zionist, but as you can imagine, intimidation is massive. And so many people are so intimidated. And they cannot come out in public. If they come out, I always tell this story. I had a very close friend of mine, and once comes over to me and tells me, I'll do everything I can to support you financially, but I have a big business in New York City. If I join you in person, they take a picture of my face, I close down the business the same day, which is unfortunately true. But when you see vocal people outside on the streets, you can imagine how many more people are behind them, supporting them in each and every way.
A few more questions. Would you be able to explain to what extent AIPAC influences the American political life?
AIPAC is a very sad entity. Unfortunately, AIPAC is manipulating each and every politician in the United States. Whoever doesn't go in total in line with AIPAC is committing political suicide. Tomorrow they'll lose their position or they would never get in office. This is unfortunately how it is. It's very sad. It's a disadvantage to everyone. And there's so much to speak about this. But unfortunately, this is something that we totally oppose. We protest AIPAC each and every year during their annual conference in Washington, D.C. And we say what we have to say about them.
What risks do Jewish activists take when they publicly criticize Israeli policies or support Palestinian rights? You've traveled a lot and you live in a country where protests have been quite...
Well, we have all different kinds of attacks, starting from verbal to physical to financial. For example, in my town where I live, it was after October 7th when we started with very intense work on Palestine. And two of our people lost prestigious positions because of their activities. They were given a choice. If you stop, then it's okay. And both of them did not choose to stop. They continued and lost the position. These kind of things happen in many other communities. This is just from my little neighborhood where I live. This happens all the time. The Zionist movement makes sure that people should be very aware the price that they are going to pay And still in all, people are brave and do what's supposed to be done. And again, coming back to that point, despite all intimidations, brave people are still doing what's supposed to be done. And this just shows you, you can imagine how many more people are behind these people, these active people. For each and every person you see on the street, there are thousands behind that individual.
You think the Jewish resistance to Zionism is growing internationally? And if yes, what signs support your view?
It is growing. We are seeing much more people today understanding way more than 2 years ago. But even, almost every decade we see a change. We see in the young generation. And when you see, the proof to that is when you see public activities, you see two things. You see more people out there. You see stronger activities, much more financial support behind it. There is so much more going on now than before.
How can Jewish communities worldwide help separate Judaism from state violence and rebuild trust with the Palestinians?
I encourage every Jewish individual, every Jewish community to make a public stance. What exactly the language should be, every individual should choose their own language, how they do it, but they should make clear that we don't support these crimes, we don't support the state of Israel, we are Jews and we are not Zionists. This is what's supposed to be done. Many, many Jewish people put a little sign on their door in front of their house. I'm a Jew, not a Zionist.
What would you say to Jewish people who reject the war but remain silent out of fear?
Well, I cannot judge those people. I can only encourage. We have to do more. Nobody should judge anyone because challenges are very difficult, and I'm not the person to judge anyone. I can only encourage. We need to do what's right. We need to do it for the sake of Almighty God. We need to do it for the sake of the oppressed people of Palestine and for the sake of the Jewish people.
How do you see the solution to the Palestinian cause? Would a referendum among the indigenous population of historical Palestine to decide the future be an ideal democratic solution?
I believe that this is not only an ideal solution. This is the only solution. We have to leave this for the Palestinian people. We have to stop all violence. We have to stop this occupation in its entirety. We need to restore all rights to all oppressed peoples. We have to allow all refugees to return to their homes, towns, and villages. And that's the only way to peace. And I'm saying this not only because the Palestinian people deserve their deserved rights, but this will be in favor of the Jewish people as well. We lived in Palestine before this state of Israel, and we didn't have a need for the state of Israel. On the contrary, the state of Israel has destroyed the safety of the Jewish people in Palestine. We would love to go back to old history and stop all these crimes, all these obstacles to peace, all these causes for conflict. And this is exactly what needs to be done. Let's leave it up to the indigenous population of Palestine to decide what government they want to have. If they want to have an Islamic religious government, we as Jewish people, we are happy because we strongly believe that by a Islamic religious government in the Holy Land, the Jewish people would be way more protected and the Jewish religion would be way more respected than today in this secular, so-called Jewish government.
What's your take on U.S. President Donald Trump's so-called peace plan that he came up with a few weeks ago?
I'm an American Jew. I'm Jewish by the religion I follow. I'm American by nationality. My religion requires of me to be respectful to the government where I live. I am respectful to my government, I'm respectful to my president, regardless whether I agree with each and every policy. That said, I can only say what my religion teaches me. The state of Israel is wrong. This has to stop in its entirety. This is what is the will of God, and this is what will bring good for everyone.
Last question. What is your view on Press TV launching a Hebrew language service? And do you think such a platform can help reach the Jewish community inside historical Palestine audiences with alternative perspectives?
This is an excellent approach. People need honest journalism. There are so many good-hearted, right-minded people that are open for the truth. But if there is no way for them to reach the truth, there is almost no option for them to come out with right decisions. This is an excellent approach, and I can only hope that this will bring so much good for humanity.
Rabbi, thank you so much for your time today.
You're very welcome.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
The following is part of the speech delivered on April 27th, 2017 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the Supreme Leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the participants of the 34th International Quran Competitions. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. All praise is due to Allah, the Lord of the Worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master and Prophet, Abul Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad, and upon his pure and infallible household. I would like to welcome all the honorable participants, particularly the dear guests who have come from various Islamic countries and who have participated in this great Quranic program. In particular, I would like to mention university professors, judges, and Quran researchers. Also, I would like to thank the officials who organized this glorious ceremony and to manage it in the best way possible. First of all, you should know that what you have done is a great deed. Today, throughout the world of Islam, every task that is carried out for the sake of the Quran and in the direction of understanding and promoting it is one of the greatest deeds that one can imagine. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Subhanallah, hamdan lillah, wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu Akbar. What you have done is a good deed. You should purify your intentions for God, and you should purge them of selfish desires and various other motivations, so that your actions will be accepted by God, and so that you will be rewarded by Allah the Exalted. And this Quranic movement should continue in our country. We are away from the Quran. We are unfamiliar with the Quran and with Quranic concepts. We should do something in this regard. We should work so hard that Quranic concepts will turn into popular concepts and public discourses among Muslim nations and countries. By Allah's favor, I will speak about this in another opportunity. What I want to say here is that we have certain concepts in the Quran which really build a powerful and glorious life for the Islamic Ummah. They are really a source of liberation from difficulties for the Islamic Ummah. We have such concepts in the Quran. In order to implement these concepts, we should primarily instill them into Muslims' minds in Islamic societies.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The spotlight.
Welcome, everyone. U.S. households are confronting a deepening affordability squeeze, and that is reshaping how they shop, dine, and finance daily life, creating new challenges for U.S. leadership, and is fueling growing discontent with U.S. President Donald Trump's job performance. In fact, a recent NBC News poll found 66% of voters feel Trump has fallen short of expectations around inflation and the cost of living. Younger Americans continue falling further behind as well. Just last month, a housing study showed that people born in the 1990s are projected to retire with home ownership rates 9.6 percentage points lower than the previous generation. Now, according to a Poverty Tracker annual report also from Columbia University, over half of U.S. residents in major cities, including a quarter of all children, either live in poverty or are low income. The price of major food staples like eggs, sugar, and meat, especially beef, increased in 2025 and are expected to continue rising. Here's a package.
U.S. President Donald Trump held a campaign-style rally at the Mount Airy Casino Resort, aiming to convince Americans that his economic policies are successfully tackling a persistent cost of living crisis. His message of a rapidly improving economy, however, was directly challenged by recent government data and the experiences of every U.S. citizen. Facing political pressure with midterm elections approaching, Trump asserted that prices were dropping, credited his administration's policies, shifting blame to his predecessor, President Joe Biden.
And I have no higher priority than making America affordable again. That's what we're going to do. And again, they caused the high prices and we're bringing them down. It's a simple message.
Trump's optimistic assessment clashes with key economic indicators. Government figures show that while the price has fallen from recent peaks, broader inflation remains stubborn. The annual consumer price index sat at 3% in September, higher than at any point during Trump's first term and above the rate in Biden's final full month in office. Essential grocery items continue to see sharp increases. Beef prices are up nearly 15%, bananas 7%, and coffee more than 20% compared to a year ago. Other metrics show job growth has slowed and unemployment has risen to a four-year high during Trump's current term. The rally revealed a notable adjustment in the Trump rhetoric. After facing criticism for recently dismissing affordability concerns as a Democratic hoax, Trump appeared to recalibrate.
And I can't say affordability hoax because I agree the prices were too high, so I can't call it a hoax because they'll misconstrue that. But they use the word affordability, and that's their only word. They say affordability, and everyone says, oh, that must mean Trump has high prices.
Trump's approval rating on his handling of the cost of living remains low at 31%, indicating the steep challenge he faces in convincing the public of an economic turnaround. U.S. citizens' daily experiences at grocery stores and gas stations are forming a powerful counter-narrative to the optimism projected from the podium. The Pennsylvania event is the first in a series planned by Trump and his cabinet ahead of the 2026 midterms. The location was strategically chosen. Pennsylvania's 8th district is a competitive area seen as critical for Republicans to hold control of Congress. For voters facing higher prices, the gap between Trump promises and their reality is widening. Millions of Americans are deeply frustrated with their affordability and their economy, threatening the very foundations of Trump's political support.
And now your guests for the program. Sir John Edmonds, economist, academic, and author, joining us out of Massachusetts. And Marcia Baker, economic expert, joining us out of Washington, D.C. Hello, and I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess we'll do the gentlemanly thing here, and Ms. Baker, we'll start with you. Your initial thoughts, please, on the financial situation that most Americans seem to find themselves in these days.
Well, the United States is in a phase of economic decline, so there's no question about the data coming out that households are facing higher prices in everything, from housing to food and so forth. But it's also true that if you have an economy where credit that is available only going into speculation, to data centers, to non-basic areas. It's not going into steel, independent farming, new health care. If these basic sectors are declining while your debts and speculation are increasing as a nation, we have $100 trillion in total government, private, and debts of all kind, plus a toxic cloud above that, of derivative and crazy speculation plus crypto. This is impossible now to hide or to deny by households. This week, just one example, Washington, the Trump administration had to announce they'll make available a bridge grant of $12 billion in aid by the end of February to farmers and ranchers in the country because their livelihoods are not stable and they're facing ruin. So definitely this is an economic decline picture, not a temporary cycle or a dip or something that's going to be fixed by today's new Federal Reserve interest rate changes.
Thank you, ma'am, for your initial take there. Professor John Edmonds, welcome to the program, sir. Mr. Edmonds, your initial take, please, on today's economic pressure on American families. Why is it just up until it seems like about 20 years ago, possibly the last time we saw a decent percentage of American families have the opportunity to sit down, plan, save, and invest for in their future was around 2005 or 6. It seems it's really like we barely hear that from families have that luxury these days.
Thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate this opportunity, and I certainly agree with the assessment of the other presenter. I'm the guy in my house who goes to the grocery store. I don't think that the president goes to very many grocery stores. I go routinely once or twice a month, and I not only buy food, but I walk around and I look at what other people are buying, and I look at what they're picking up and putting back on the shelf. And I can tell you that a lot of things that I routinely buy are much more expensive. I buy them anyway because I'm above all that, but I'm very aware of the effect of the tariffs. For example, I'm very, very much a fan of coffee, especially premium coffee, and premium coffee is a lot more expensive than it was, even though they just rolled back the tariff on coffee from Brazil. Besides that, I think we should mention the price of eggs, which a lot of people were talking about. But one reason why eggs have come down more than some other foodstuffs recently is because the farmers who grew a bunch of corn and soybeans are not able to sell it to China because China has decided that if you want to have a trade war, let's hit the group that voted in highest numbers for this government. And so they're sitting there with corn. Now you can either let it rot or you can feed it to pigs and chicken and get pork and eggs and chicken out of it. Or you can grind it up and make ethanol out of it. And ethanol is intrinsically uneconomical, especially now that we have net exports of crude oil and refined products. Mm. So I would say the cost of living is definitely going up, and a lot of people are feeling it, regardless of what anybody might say. And the other question I would bring up is, how much trust should we have in the data? I lived in third world countries where they would routinely adjust the numbers, or as we say in American slang, fudge them. But in the U.S., after the Bureau of Labor Statistics head was fired, the next person miraculously reported better numbers. I'm really astonished to tell you that, but it's not really a joke. It's if I got that job, I wouldn't put out any bad numbers either, but I wouldn't put out any true numbers.
Thank you, Mr. Edmonds. Ms. Baker, Democrats, meanwhile, they're making this issue of affordability central to many of their campaigns now, while Trump has called it, these affordability concerns, a Democratic hoax. But my question to you, how much of this mismanagement can be attributed to his administration? How much of it is just part of the trajectory that's been moving regardless of which party's been in the Oval Office over the past few decades?
I'm sorry to say it's your suggestion that it's both parties plus independents for many decades that allowed the increased deregulation of the economy, including in North America with Canada, Mexico, and allowed transnationals to come in the case of food, which John was just mentioning shopping for, allowing the United States is 70% dependent for fresh tomatoes from Mexico that come in trucks. Mexico, the home of corn, is 50% dependent on the U.S. sending corn to Mexico, who gains? The Wall Street complex of transnationals, Cargill, JBS, the meat packer. We have a terminal condition of our United States economy, and it's been Democrats, Republicans all going for it. So now is the point where we have to make a change.
I'll put that same question to you, Mr. Edmonds. How guilty do you see the Trump administration? A recent poll shows two-thirds of Americans feel he is completely disconnected. His policies only favor billionaires and the wealthy. And if he has nothing, if he has little, less to do with this current crisis than many want to lead on to believing, nevertheless, it seems fair to say that his tariff wars are at least to blame to an extent. But your overall assessment of his administration's really the hand they played in this current cost of living crisis in America?
The tariff wars are a big part of the current situation, but I would reaffirm what Marcia just said, that it's been many years since younger people are looking forward to having less prosperity than their parents had, and you can't do that very long and remain popular. But I would also reaffirm what Marcia said about favoring Wall Street tycoons, and particularly in the first Trump government, there was an enormous tax law change that greatly favored corporations and the wealthy. And then we have another one in this previously passed so-called Big Bill, Beautiful Bill. And the consequence is that if you make more money speculating on stocks, particularly the big seven, the magnificent seven, as they're called, and you make more on that than you would on what I call real business, that is going out and making physical products. And with regard to trade in agricultural goods, yes, certainly, we have brought in tomatoes from Mexico for many, many years. And we also brought in labor from Mexico going back to the 1940s to pick the tomatoes. And then we found that many of them were staying. And then now this is a wave of anti-immigrant sentiment. So the people that used to do the physical labor in construction and the physical labor in agriculture are being sent back to where they came from, if it really is that they were not born here. But many of the people who've been picked up and deported were U.S. citizens, but that's not the subject of this particular show. But what we have is a labor shortage in several skill categories, particularly the high skill categories. People that take my classes, for example, half of them are foreigners, and if they don't leave, then they face a deportation notice pretty quickly. But then, if you look at who's actually doing the heavy physical labor, who cut your grass, who laundered your shirts, who was working the back room of the restaurant where you went and ate with your friends, those people are being run out of the country. And near where I live, I'm hiring people to cut my lawn who are teenagers from the neighborhood, but they're all just leaving very promptly and going to college, so they're not available anymore. So that's turning into a pattern, which is stratification of the population, and stratification not just a rich versus poor, but super rich, not so very rich, and then the poor, we have to divide them into lower middle class and really, really poor, and we're going to see them really poor after the 1st of January when their health care premiums go up. A lot of people are going to have to drop health care, and those who retain it won't have money for anything else.
The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines. featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Ms. Baker, nearly $1 trillion, you very well know, in military spending each and every year. And ironically, the student loan debt that's accrued over all the years has reached an unprecedented $1.81 trillion today, according to the Education Data Initiative. Can some of the problems in the U.S. financially be better resolved if there's a logical and calculated reshuffling of priorities by policymakers?
Yes, that is part of it. In other words, we should reset policy based on principle, which we can work out. We have precedents in the 1930s in the United States when the new president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, came in. A bill was passed named after two senators called Glass and Senator Stegall, and they reorganized banking. So you had banking of credit you need for operations and economic activity, and you did not back up finance for speculation. You put a wall in between. There is a move now, rightly, to reintroduce that in the United States. And it has, in different forms, it has a universal principle. China observes it. Other nations observe it. So that's the kind of setting aside unworthy, unpayable debt. I call unworthy debt a lot of the trillions in speculative counter obligations on derivatives connected to Wall Street, City of London, the international billionaire class. It's going to otherwise explode. I can't tell you which day, but it's unsustainable. Then we can organize credit for priority projects, rebuild rail, and collude the majority who's building in Africa and other places, ports, dams, electricity, that can get us out of the otherwise inevitable crisis you're seeing worsen here in the U.S.
I can put that same question to you, Mr. Edmonds. Today, you very well know unemployment, well, you may not know, but unemployment today in America has risen to its highest level in 4 years, and consumer prices, this you know, remain high and seem to be getting worse by the day. Housing costs are a nightmare, whether you're a buying or a renter or paying a mortgage. I mean, higher education, you very well know it's very pricey, while entry-level jobs for a graduate pay the equivalent of a fast food chain. What needs to change by policymakers to address this current crisis?
Well, let's start with the student loans. When I got my various degrees, I graduated owing $11,000 in debt. And my salary was much higher than that already. But then besides that, the interest rate on those debts were low, inflation was high, and the interest was tax deductible. So by the time I finished paying off those loans, they were less than my monthly electric bill, and I honestly didn't even notice it. Whereas this generation, if they got half the degrees that I have, they would have a debt burden that they can't pay. Now, another thing that has really happened, which is quite profound and definitely damaging the generation of people that are now turning 18 or 25, is the compensation that people get is so much lower. When I was an undergrad, I got a job washing dishes for a while for $2.50 an hour. And then a very short while later, I got a job programming computers at $10 an hour. In other words, the ratio of 4 to 1, what I got for white collar work versus blue collar work. That ratio is now nowhere near as large. I mean, right now, people around where I am right now are making $17 an hour working in a fast food restaurant. And if they're running the cash register, they're making $19 an hour. And if they're sitting in the office doing the books, they're probably also making $19 or maybe $21 an hour. And then where's the 4 to 1 ratio? It's gone. So getting a college degree, I cannot look an 18-year-old in the eye right now and say you should bend every effort and even incur some debt to get a college degree. It wouldn't be a rewarding investment. And that's devastating. And when you combine that with deporting the people that do get a college degree, you end up with a population that is underqualified for the jobs that are available. So unemployment comes from that. That is to say, there's a lot of people out there who'd like to have a job, or they'd like to have a better job than what they have now, but they can't qualify. They don't have the skill levels, and that's chronic. It's throughout the country, and it seems to just be a fact of life, and you can complain about it, but you can't seem to make it any better.
And since, well, I was going to ask a different question, Ms. Baker, but since Mr. Edmonds referred to deporting and immigrants a few times, I'll put this question to you if I could. Politicians, especially Donald Trump, he seized on the opportunity time and again to evade any responsibility for the current economic affairs of the country, and he's pitting his base against immigrants, saying that they're taking your jobs, putting strain on medical and educational infrastructure. Let's build a wall to keep them out, or let's just launch a campaign to round them up and kick them out. Is this the answer, ma'am? All the billions to Ukraine and Israel to fund an unwinnable war or fund a genocide close by, these don't get spoken about, but immigrants somehow are the demons in America today.
Well, this is both ideology and a kind of low-level reflex reaction that's no good, doesn't work, is cruel and mean. And as John has already said, if you have a difficult situation, then you load on tariffs, then you blame migration because Wall Street has not allowed economic development in Central America, in South America. So people are dislocated, looking for where they can have better lives. If you follow that path, it's hopeless, and it's also very dangerous now, being on the verge of having this stupid policy cause an attack on Venezuela here in our own hemisphere. That's crazy. Instead, if you have the development approach, that's the basis for peace and for hope in the future. And so mutually looking at development in ports, in railroads in North America, building the Alaska to lower 48 down to through Central America to South America railroad that was never properly built. That means jobs. It means a spirit of optimism. It means high skills. And when people's homelands are being developed, whether it's in Haiti or Peru or Honduras, you want to stay home and be part of the excitement. Instead, we've had this anti-development policy for over half a century or more, and inevitably that creates dislocated people. So that's the fight.
And Mr. Edmonds, I'm going to put the final thoughts with you, sir, if I could. Many Americans, I read this article just before the show by the Economic Times. It says, many Americans feel trapped in a cycle where income barely covers living costs and every paycheck is a race against time. The strain affects mental health, family stability, and productivity, creating ripple effects across communities. Now, 68% of Americans are walking a financial tightrope, and some studies suggest 7 out of 10 Americans are living paycheck to paycheck, and this includes families from not just low income levels, but all income levels, which is quite remarkable. Why is a country, sir, this rich, have so many families this broke?
The paycheck to paycheck argument is certainly true. I would push the ratio even higher than that. A great many people are not really able to afford the life that they think they should have. And one thing that they can't do, they can't relocate to get another job. They can get the job, perhaps, but the job may be in another city. And there's two things that restrict their mobility. One is housing. If they have a housing situation that they can afford, and they move out of that, and they move into one that they can't afford, either because of mortgage rates or because of higher rents in the places where the jobs are. But also,